Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We've been examining the circumstances of the nation's and the state of Ohio's system of mass incarceration this month. Today, in the final segment of our four-part series, we address the role of victims and victim advocates. It's easy to find the numbers behind the victims. In 2011 and 2012, per 100,000 people, there were roughly 5 homicides, 27 rapes, 114 robberies, and 242 aggravated assaults, among many other crimes, 700 burglaries, some 2,000 larceny thefts, and 230 motor vehicle thefts. But until the last few decades, the role of the victim in the prosecution and punishment of the perpetrator was limited to victim. Now, victims have several voices. Joining us now by phone is the Ohio Parole Board's victims representative, Kathleen Kovac. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
What is the role now of the victim in the parole hearing process, or I guess the whole paroling process?
Yes, good question. As you know, in your series, you've been talking about significantly the amount of parole hearings that we have. And I've been in victim advocacy for over 23 years now. And over that time, and even on my 11 and a half years on the board, the voice of the victim continues to be stronger in the what we would say the post-conviction process or here when it comes time to parole. Victims have very specific rights, especially when it comes to parole hearings. Some very significant legislation impacted the board's ability or actually our statutory duties in terms of notification to victims in order to provide input prior to an offender's parole board hearing. And that was in 2013. And what that did is, and it expanded the notification that the board is now mandated and required to provide to victims, to survivors, to have the opportunity to have a voice in the parole process.
What was it before that?
Mm-hmm.
How did it expand it?
Right. There's a couple things, and just so you know what I'm referencing, the bill is called Senate Bill 160, and it pertains to, it's often called Laura's Law. And what the bill has done is it's changed the prior law in terms of timing of notifications. So victims now are able to provide input. It used to be we would send out notices to only registered victims. Okay, so these are victims that had called the department and registered to be notified.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now we have to provide notification on what we would say is an opt-out basis. So basically, we have to go out there now. We have an entire unit that does searches for victims. So as you can imagine, we are required by law now on offenses of violence
mm-hmm.
to contact victims and survivors at least 60 days. So 60 days prior to a parole board hearing. So you can imagine the daunting task that was at first
mm-hmm.
when we're having cases that are 10, 20, 30, some even 40 years old,
right.
Trying to go back and find survivors. And we've had to establish an entire notification unit, an entire unit that is actually dedicated to locating and finding victims and survivors.
My guest is Kathleen Kovac. She's an Ohio Parole Board victims representative. This is the fourth in our series on mass incarceration in Ohio and the United States. If you have a question or comment about the victim's role in the parole process, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. Kathleen, go ahead.
Yeah, and as far as the victim's role, just to let you know, the parole board had previously had victims given them the opportunity to participate in what's called a victim conference day the month before an offender's parole board hearing if they wanted to sit down one-on-one with an individual board member and provide input. And this the new legislation has mandated us now to do that. So it's no longer a courtesy. It's a mandate that we have to allow them at least up to 1 hour to sit down and speak to either a parole board member in person. This could also be telephone, and we've even done video conferencing, and because some victims, frankly, don't have money to travel if they live out of state, etc.
What happens during that hour?
Yeah, this is their hour. This, for a lot of victims, this is their first time to ever be able to provide input, what they want the board to factor into consideration prior to releasing the offender that harmed them or their family in the community.
Why is it their first time?
Why is it their first time?
Yeah, isn't it brought up in the original? Oh, because of, the, like, for instance, the older crimes?
Exactly.
Okay.
We're dealing with the types of crimes that the parole board has dealt is dealing with. As you said, I mean, this series is on victims' rights. Mm-hmm. This has been an evolving process. And for some, back when I started 23 years ago, mm-hmm. There wasn't anything to hold, prosecutors' offices, law enforcement accountable to make sure the victim is involved in the system.
It makes me wonder, since you have a good long history in the system, do you have a different experience with victims or survivors who did have a voice in the first place in the prosecution and in the sentencing phase of the system versus those who maybe the crimes are 40 years old and they never had a voice in the beginning?
Right. I think the biggest thing that I hear at a victim conference, whether they've been involved at the court level or not, is when they hear a sentence, and so the offender is either found guilty by a jury or ends up pleading guilty and is sentenced in court. Let's take the example of aggravated murder. Perhaps the inmate was stood there in before the court and the sentencing judge, and the judge handed down, let's say, a 25-year-to-life sentence for aggravated murder. Mm-hmm. And perhaps the family was able to address the judge and give a victim impact statement prior to him passing that sentence. We have to realize at that time of sentencing, the victims are hearing, 25 years to life. And not expecting, 25 years to come around, especially when we're looking at, as you said, Ms. Mauser was on and talked about the old law inmates.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very difficult to have a family in front of you and try and explain a system and explain things that might not make sense to them. So, for example, why are we seeing an offender who served 15 years when they were standing there in court and heard that the sentence was 20 to life? So, again, they hear the life component, and I think a lot of times offenders and their families hear the minimum. They hear the 15.
Are they given anything in writing? I know if I just go to visit a doctor, it helps if someone writes stuff down, because sometimes you're not listening as closely or as well as you could be.
Right. Are they given anything in writing at our victim conference days?
Right. Well, maybe at the point of sentencing. Are they armed with the information they need to know about what their rights are, what this sentence involves, what it means?
Yeah, and now that does happen. But again, a lot of these cases that we see back then, there was no constitutional amendment in the state of Ohio that required them to be given that information at the time.
Can you describe how a victim's experience, how that hour conference with a board member would shape the way an inmate is whether or not an inmate's paroled?
Right. Well, it's just one of the many factors that we do consider, and it is on a case-by-case basis. Each case is so different from one another. And the conferences and the time that we are sitting down with families and victims, they're very, we try to make it as comfortable as possible because, of course, you can only imagine the anxiety that these folks have.
Yeah, these are violent crimes, once again.
These are violent crimes. So mostly we're talking murder, ag murder, or some sort of a life sex offense or a sex offense. So, imagine what's going through their minds coming into this, you know, meeting with a parole board, knowing that an offender is, you know, being considered for release back into the community. So a lot of the time is spent, explaining the process. So they understand, number one, that their role, and they understand that the information that they share with the board, that is, you know, I think a big fear for victims coming into these days is confidentiality. Are we going to go tell the offender everything that, you know, they shared with us mm-hmm. as to, you know, how this crime has, you know, changed their lives? And a lot of times what we're finding is, you know, they are very emotional conferences, but the conferences really, it's the only time that the board has to actually find out the impact from the victim, from the survivor, that this violent crime has had on their lives. Prior to this, we don't have that information.
Right. When we talked about the parole board a few weeks ago, the issue of the seriousness of the crime came up and how it is often paramount in parole decisions, and that's something that never changes, no matter how much the inmate might change. Over time, however, victims sometimes want the inmate paroled. They're ready
Absolutely.
To move on. They've forgiven them. Do their opinions weigh differently when they want parole?
Yeah. I just want to make sure that you know, your audience is fully aware is that the board considers all input, and you have to understand, too, like you said, I've met many times with victims who've come in for those victim conference days where it's just, in fact, that they wish to support the release of the offender. And, of course, we are going to weigh that in to our consideration as well.
Is it weighed as much as if they didn't want them paroled?
Absolutely. Okay. I think it's all weighed the same in terms of that. But you have to understand, too, often in those scenarios, there's also sometimes it's so difficult, families are even split. When I say split, you know, maybe a mother of a murder victim says that they don't want the offender released, but the sister says, you know, they've done it, you know, I feel that they've done enough time as long as they've, you know, make good use of their time, rehabilitated themselves.
Does it matter if the victim or the survivor has heard from the inmate? I mean, that there's been some mm-hmm. contact and that they're not just doing it in a very isolated decision-making process, but they've maybe the inmate's apologized. They've convinced them that they've rehabilitated, that sort of thing.
Right. That's a good question. One of the things the department does not allow is for offenders should not be reaching out to victims and, for example, saying, hey, I'm coming up for a parole hearing.
Right.
That's what, and I just want to let you know what I've done. We do have Office of Victim Services. That's a whole division where we have four full-time advocates working in our department with every victim-related issue. And one of those things is, you know, just that. You know, these advocates sit down with victims and they find out exactly what their wishes are, where they're at in the process, and try and answer those kinds of questions.
Go ahead.
And I was going to say, offenders also do have the opportunity, and there's a victim awareness program that is offered in our department.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, groups such as Parents of Murdered Children, Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, were instrumental in assisting the department in getting this very structured 12-week program completed. And the inmates can participate in that. And part of that process is writing an apology letter to the victim or the family of the victim. Now, the letter is not mailed directly to the victim or the family. However, that letter does become available. So should the family member ever call in and say, you know, I want to know, you know, is he sorry or she sorry for what they've done? And we certainly will provide them with that letter.
And victims know that letter is available.
Right.
If
there's a letter available.
I wouldn't know to ask if you didn't tell me to.
And again, and that's something, too, that we cover at Victim Conference Day as well.
Okay.
So that's another advantage to those days.
Let's take a quick question before I have to let you go. Fred in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Fred.
Hi. Just curious about what was the role for the parole board when the victims present evidence that a threat has been made against them, some form of retaliation or against witnesses or whatever, at some point before or after the crime, does the parole board take that into consideration?
Thank you. Absolutely, we take that into consideration, and, you know, our decisions are only as good as the information that we have. So it's often been very beneficial for us to sit down with prosecutors, to sit down with law enforcement, and have them, you know, share, did you know that at sentencing this indirect threat was made? And we have every reason to believe that the victim's safety would be in jeopardy, or a threat perhaps that came during incarceration as well. We have investigators that look into all of that. Another thing that we do with victims is say, if they are being contacted, even by a third party, when it's close to a parole hearing and they just feel something isn't right in terms of that contact, they need to let us know.
All right, Fred, thanks a lot for your call. Kathleen Kovac, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Kathleen Kovac, she's an Ohio Parole Board victims representative. Coming up, more on the victims part of the equation when it comes to the mass incarceration in Ohio and the United States. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We've been examining the circumstances of the nation's and the state of Ohio's system of mass incarceration this month. Today, in the final segment of our four-part series, we address the role of victims and victims' advocates. Joining us now is the Legal Clinic Director for the Justice League of Ohio. That's an organization that provides legal resources to victims of crime. Elizabeth Well, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Also joining us by phone from Cincinnati is the director of the Ohio Justice and Policy Center, David Singleton. Welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me in.
Elizabeth, well, how have victims' rights changed over time?
I was actually listening to the show in the lobby as I was waiting to come in, and I completely agree with what Kathleen said in terms of the changes in the parole system.
It's been pretty recent, even, some of the changes.
It really has. If you go back to, 1982, Ronald Reagan commissioned a task force on victims' rights. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it or not. But that was really the first time that states began to think about victims in the criminal justice process at all. And from that point forward, you can see legislation and constitutional amendments beginning that provide crime victims' rights throughout the entire criminal justice process, not just the parole process.
Has it necessarily meant that inmates are paroled less often? Has it had any kind of measurable impact on the system of parole?
Honestly, we do not have a lot of issues with the parole system. We don't get a lot of complaints from victims in that arena. I think what Kathleen is saying is true, and they're doing a phenomenal job with having victims coming in. I would hope that the victims are playing at least some role when they're talking about their experiences that perhaps were not considered before all of these new laws.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of times there's a misconception that defendants' rights and victims' rights are a zero-sum game, and that's just not the case.
David Singleton, do you have a sense, has there been any work done on what the impact might have been on the parole process as victims' rights have gained strength?
Well, anecdotally, I think that what has happened is that the parole board has been less likely to let folks out. That's anecdotally what I've observed when victims are speaking up. But I do agree that this isn't a zero-sum game. I think that we can all agree that it's important to make sure that victims are heard, that their voices are listened to, and that they have a say in how best they can heal from the harm that was caused them. I would like to see more restorative justice model in Ohio and around the country that focuses more on how do we heal the harm that an individual victim has suffered that is not necessarily going to be through locking someone up and throwing away the key, but the victim's voice should be heard and primarily listened to in the sense of how best can that person heal. And it's not going to always be through a lengthy period of incarceration. And in fact, the more money we waste locking up people who don't need to be behind bars, which is a huge problem in Ohio and across the country, the fewer dollars we have available to repair the harm that victims have suffered and make sure that they're whole.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. This is the final segment today in our four-part series on mass incarceration in Ohio and the nation. My guests, Elizabeth Wells, she is Legal Clinic Director for the Justice League of Ohio. That's an organization that provides legal resources to victims of crime. And also David Singleton, Director of the Ohio Justice and Policy Center. If you have a question or comment about the parole process as it regards victims and about what victims' rights are, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's talk about that idea of restorative justice. It focuses on the needs of the victim, the offender, and the community, not the justice system. Hasn't the system always focused on those needs, Elizabeth Well?
Arguably, no. I think that it is a relatively new idea, and I do see a movement toward restorative justice, and I completely agree with what David was saying. A lot of victims, simply the process of being able to give a statement and feel that their voice is heard is extremely healing for them. And I've had a lot of victims personally that say, this is not about someone being locked away forever. This is about someone admitting that they were wrong, that, you know, I was harmed, acknowledging that I was harmed. And I've had a lot of victims that I think would be completely fine with a move more towards a restorative justice model.
You know, David Singleton, just as a passive observer, someone who reads the newspaper, someone's convicted of a crime and they're going to go away. And it always frustrates me that they never say why they did it. And there's that kind of that missing link. It's an emotional issue more than anything. Yeah, I'm not a victim per se, but what about that emotional piece from the inmate's point of view? Do they feel the same way?
I think it depends on the person. I know that there are, from my conversations with clients that I represent who are incarcerated, many do feel a deep sense that they did something wrong and they want to be able to repair it. But our system isn't really set up for that. I mean, it's adversarial. So in the course of the trial, often it's not about admitting your wrongdoing. It's about trying to find a way to not get hammered and locked away forever. And, you know, sentencing is an opportunity for folks who are being sentenced to speak up and to apologize. And that does happen. It does happen. But I don't think that the emphasis is on how do we repair the harm to the victim. And I think that sometimes the person who's committed the crime is in a situation where they're really more focused on how to avoid going to prison for a long time, and the focus is not so much on what do I say to really repair the wound. But there are some, clients that I've had who mm-hmm. are very outspoken in the sentencing process about how they've done wrong and done harm, and they want to seek a way to repair it.
Elizabeth, what sorts of services does the Justice League of Ohio provide to victims of crime?
Quite a few. A lot of what we do is we're trying to collaborate with as many organizations as possible to provide kind of a full spectrum of services. So, you know, we'll do referrals to make sure our victims are getting therapy, et cetera. What we do directly is legal assistance and actually at times legal representation for crime victims to make sure that their rights under Ohio Revised Code 2930 are being upheld.
Is there a problem with that? Give me an example of how their rights wouldn't be upheld.
We've had cases. We work all across the state. We're a statewide organization. victims have certain rights, such as, for instance, a very strong right is the right to be present during all phases of the criminal justice system, unless there's actually proof that it's going to harm a defendant's fair trial rights. Mm-hmm. But a lot of courts will do a separation of witnesses and just exclude the victim from the vast majority of the trial, which is actually in contradiction to state statutes, arguably the Constitution, as well as evidence rules. So we would go in at that point and file a motion briefing the court on the law and telling them, you know, we really think that absent a showing by the defendant, the victim should be able to be present.
David Singleton, can you talk about how a victim's presence during a trial could harm the defendant's rights?
Well, it could. It could if the victim was going to be a critical witness, obviously would be a witness at the trial, and if the I do think that that it's important to protect victims, but at that point of the trial, that person is an alleged victim, and there are times when a person who claims to be a victim is really not a victim. And if the trial is a process about seeking the truth, then it would be important not to have a complainant, I would use that term, at the trial, be able to tailor his or her testimony based on what they hear, come out from other witnesses. So that is a concern, and that's an important balance that has to be struck because, you know, a person on trial for a crime has a right to a fair process. So I think that there are competing concerns there that require a balance to be struck.
Elizabeth, well, that's a pretty important distinction. How do you approach that in the work you do with complainants or alleged victims at that stage of the process?
Well, I would just say that that's actually the argument that we hear all the time, the counter argument. And if you actually examine what's happened in the state and across the nation, courts have never found that a victim's mere presence is enough to disturb the defendant's fair trial rights. So that's something that, of course, I'm going to point out. Now, I completely understand, and we always advise victims, if you have an emotional outburst, you know, if you clearly change your story, that's a totally different thing. But mere presence alone is really what we're going for.
Is it your role at all to advise alleged victims at that stage, if they are very emotional people, if they are going to tend to have outbursts, to not be there?
I would advise a victim. I wouldn't say don't be there because that's their right,
gotcha.
In my opinion.
Yeah, of course.
But I would tell them, if you have an emotional outburst, that's potentially grounds for an appeal. No one wants that. So if you feel that you may have an outburst, you may want to consider whether you want to exercise your right, because it's ultimately always up to the victim whether they want to exercise any of the rights they have.
To what extent are you involved with victims at the parole stage?
As I said, we really haven't had a lot of issues. We're mostly advising victims. Mm-hmm. I've never represented a victim at a parole stage. It's typically more they call in with questions about what to expect, mm-hmm. and less so that their rights have been violated. My experience in Ohio has been that at the parole stage, you know, victims are notified. They are given that conference for an hour to speak with the board, and they're allowed to make a statement at the parole hearing as well, an additional victim impact statement pursuant to statute. So we honestly, as long as I've been at the organization, have not had a complaint that a right wasn't upheld at that stage.
Have you had victims that were concerned about the perpetrator and how they were going to be treated, more empathetic than we might ordinarily think?
At times we have victims and the perpetrators are family members, and in that case—
Often that's the case, right?
And in that case, it does, you know, there is somewhat of striking of a balance, because they'll say, you know, for domestic violence, for instance, you know, this is still someone that I care about. I don't want them to be locked away forever. And with domestic violence in particular, you'll often see victims that might come and make a victim impact statement at any stage of the proceeding, actually in favor of not throwing someone away. Locking someone up and mm-hmm. throwing away the key.
Mm-hmm.
So you do run into that with certain crimes, or, you know, when you have a relationship of a family member. So,
David Singleton, when it comes to victims, I asked about earlier with the parole board's victims representative whether or not when the victim's role is against the inmate getting out, that's one thing. When the victim takes the role of supporting the inmate getting out, do you have any sense, anecdotally or otherwise, that that weighs differently?
My sense anecdotally is that that does matter, but it doesn't control. The parole board has a mind of its own. That is one thing that I have learned over the course of doing the work that I do and having support of victims may help some, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's dispositive.
Has the overall change in the laws benefiting victims, giving them more, well, not giving them more rights, but clarifying their rights more thoroughly and laying out what they can expect in the criminal justice system, has that been a good thing, or has that been, you said it's a zero sum. Can you go into more, a little more detail about what it means overall to the criminal justice system and maybe to the issue of mass incarceration?
I don't think it's zero sum. I agree with Elizabeth on that.
And it's by not that, zero sum, I mean. Yes, right.
And by that, I mean that just because victims have rights now that are recognized by statute doesn't mean that that is necessarily taking away something from, you know, people who have been convicted of crimes. What I think is hasn't happened to the extent it could is involving victims in the movement to reduce mass incarceration. I think that there should be more effort to do that because they have a very important voice. They are stakeholders in our communities, and some are not going to care about mass incarceration, but others might, and others might see that when we lock up people at the rates we lock them up, we all lose as a community if we are spending money that could be better spent on repairing the harm to victims in different ways, better service to victims and things of that nature. And so my hope is that we can involve victims in the movement to end mass incarceration in our state and across the nation.
Does that at all, Elizabeth, well, fit into the role of what you do?
Basically, my role is I'm an attorney for the victim. So if the victim wants to go and make a victim impact statement that's going to say, you know, I've forgiven this person, I feel like it's better for both of us if we move on, I don't believe in locking him up or her up forever, I completely support that. By the same token, if the victim says, look, I was really damaged by this crime, I want to tell everyone how this has affected me in every single aspect of my life, I support that. So it's really a victim-by-victim analysis for me, and I support them in no matter what they want to do.
Is there any ever been a time when you wish that the victim and the inmate or, the perpetrator, the person convicted of the crime, could have contact? They could know more about what they've gone through? Maybe the victim, because I knew whether or not they were rehabilitated. I wish I knew what they've done. I wish I could talk to them and see if I feel differently about them.
Honestly, for us, the vast majority of the victims that we represent have been victims of, you know, sexual assaults. They may be the surviving members of a murdered individual, mm-hmm. members of a family of a murdered individual. So typically, they don't really want to have contact with their perpetrator. We're a pretty small organization, so we can't take on, you know, your everyday assaults and things like that. Mm-hmm. I do feel like in certain circumstances, there are victims who would want to know that their offender has been rehabilitated. We don't typically run into that just because of the nature of the victims that we represent.
Okay. Well, Elizabeth Well, thanks for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
No problem. I was glad to be here.
Elizabeth Well, she's Legal Clinic Director for the Justice League of Ohio. That's an organization that provides legal resources to victims of crime. David Singleton, you're going to stay with us, right?
I sure am.
All right. And we'll continue. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We've been examining the circumstances of the nation's and the state of Ohio's system of mass incarceration this month. Today, in the final segment of our four-part series, we address the role of victims and victims' advocates. Many victims are called to support the state in prosecuting and sentencing a criminal, but not all victims agree with the state's opinion on the length of sentencing. Still with us is David Singleton, director of the Ohio Justice and Policy Center, and joining us now is Donna Foster, whose son James was murdered in 1991. She is now seeking the parole of her son's killer, Roosevelt Barron. Donna Foster, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Your point of view is not unique, but it's still unusual. How do you feel your opinion in this case has been embraced or not by the criminal justice system?
Well, I represent Epidemic, and the CEO there is Tim Richardson. And I would like to, number one, give out a contact number for anyone.
We will post numbers and contact numbers on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. But first of all, how do you feel you've been received by the criminal justice system and what you do?
I think I have not had much experience with my particular situation, but I do believe that my correspondence with the parole board has been good and has been convenient for me. Mm-hmm. So, but I don't have a lot of contact with the criminal justice system. The man that killed my son, I want him freed.
Why?
Because I have forgiven him.
Mm-hmm. Tell us how that happened and what you've gone through.
The young man that killed my son was only 16 years old, and he had a lot to do with the case being won. He testified against the people that that had him do the killing. He did not know my son.
Okay.
And he asked me to forgive him in the courtroom, and it wasn't an easy process. I prayed a lot on it. And my relationship with the Lord said, okay, forgive him.
How long was that after he was convicted?
The trial went on for years because, number one, they burned him before they killed my son. So that was another trial in itself. And they killed him 4 days before the other trial started. Because it was, they had to restart the trial again because of some errors.
Okay.
And so it took, the process was heavy on my heart when he asked me to forgive him. And I do believe, I think the duration was 6 months.
Okay. And how long was he convicted? He was sentenced to
15 years to life for the murder and 3 years for gun specification.
Mm-hmm. So about 18 to 20.
Yes.
You said about 6 months. Does forgiving for you mean he should be let out?
Yes.
Okay. You didn't think he should serve any time?
He served 23 years.
Okay.
He's did his time. I believe in second chances. That was a child. He was a child. And I'm a teacher now, but I worked before I taught school. I was a supervisor for Hamilton County Juvenile Court. And I understand how young people can be persuaded to do things. That's a baby. That's a child. He was a child. And he was afraid. So he did what the big guys told him to do. And I have to take all of that in consideration. He's remorseful. I talked with him last Saturday. I spoke with him on the phone.
Is it pretty easy to stay in contact with him?
Yes. Academic makes sure I continue to have a contact and a relationship with him. those five people in that organization is they're my strength. That organization is a wonderful organization.
David Singleton, how many people are there like Donna Foster out there that are seeking the parole of an inmate in an Ohio prison?
Probably more than we would all think. And let me just first of all say, Ms. Foster, I am so sorry for your loss. And I also applaud you for the courage of speaking up and for how you feel. And if you also had felt like you wanted your son's killer to be locked up for a much longer period of time, I also would understand that. It's amazing that you've come to the place where you've come. But back to your question, Anne, I think that there are more people out there than we would think who feel the way that Ms. Foster feels. They don't get the coverage in the news that you would expect, or that might be helpful. I actually don't expect that you'd get coverage of the Ms. Fosters of the world. But there are folks out there who are willing to forgive, have forgiven, and, you know, everybody should want to see someone held accountable for committing a serious crime like killing someone. But at what point is enough enough? And that is what I hear Ms. Foster saying right now.
You're exactly right.
How many... Do we have a sense about how many people are in prison now who went there at about the same age as Roosevelt Barron? He was a child when he killed Donna Foster's son. A lot of them start out that young in prison?
Yeah, they do. And I don't have a specific number to give you, but I have one of the things that we're doing in this office is we are doing a big report about the parole system, and a lot of the folks that I've met have gone to prison when they were 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, young people,
mm-hmm.
completely different now, have changed
have
in
reformed.
Profound ways.
Mm-hmm.
Donna Foster, when you came to the decision 6 months, was it after the trial or after your son was murdered?
Oh, no, ma'am. That trial lasted 3 years or more.
So it was even during the trial process that you had come to the point where you forgave?
Yes, ma'am.
And yet he was still sentenced to many years. Was that because the sentencing was required?
For that particular crime? Yes,
right.
Ma'am.
There was no leeway?
No. For murder, and he was found guilty, and that's...
So, David Singleton, Donna Foster's voice in that case doesn't really matter at that point.
It doesn't at that point. The judge's hands were tied in terms of what the sentence would be. And it sounds like the sentence was, an 18 to life because there was a, 15 to life for the murder and then three for a gun specification. But this is where the parole board comes in. I mean, the parole board, as we talked about previously, Anne, often takes the view that it's a serious crime, so therefore they're going to continue to flop the person, which is the term for keep them in after they've reached their minimum date that they have to serve.
Yeah, they'll say they get a 5-year flop or a 10-year flop or something
flop.
Like that, yeah.
And so far, it sounds like Ms. Foster's son's killer has gotten 5 years beyond the 18.
Mm-hmm.
And at what point is that enough? Ms. Foster says, look, I've forgiven him. Please hear my voice. And hopefully the parole board will soon hear your voice, Ms. Foster. And if there's any way I can help you with this, too, I would love to do that. We can connect offline.
Oh, that'd be great. That'd be great. But my comment on this is it's a lot of things that happen during the qualifications of him being released. They lost some of the, he complied to what they wanted, and it wasn't reported that he had done these things in order to be released to. And I think that's an injustice.
Loss of just files being lost and that sort of thing.
Right. I thought that was a real injustice for this young man.
You said earlier that he's been reformed.
Yes.
How do you measure that? Why do you think he's been reformed?
I have no control over that. I just know it in my heart.
Yeah, okay.
And in my spirit.
So it's not like certain classes he's taken or things he's done with his life in prison.
I have no knowledge of some of the requirements that it took for him to be even granted a parole hearing. All I know is that this young man has served his time. He's did what the law said he needed to do.
Did you talk with the parole board? Did you have one of those conferences?
Yes, I have a phone conference.
5 years ago when he was first up for parole?
Yes, ma'am.
What was that like?
The parole board was very empathetic about what I wanted. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how big of a consideration he took it because he wasn't granted.
Mm-hmm.
But now I'm finding little tits and pieces about why some things wasn't granted to
like
him.
The documents weren't
right.
where they should
yes.
have been. Yeah.
So
have you spoken with the parole board again as he comes up for parole again?
Or how I am. I am, as we speaking, writing a letter requesting a visit.
Okay.
And I have a phone number that I will call when I return home. And they will take me through the process of how I personally can go to the parole board and speak.
Does having him in prison, the guy who killed your son, does that make the healing process for you as a parent who's lost a child? Does it exacerbate it? Does it make it harder?
Both.
Would you feel better if he was out?
I don't know. He's not out. So I can't answer that.
Okay.
But
do you
I
think
want him
you
out.
Would? Okay.
Yes. Because I do believe we have a message together. I hope that Roosevelt and I can come to an even level to go across country with this story. And I introduce him to the young people of the world, sharing his story about the choices young people make that affect everybody, family, friends. And I hope that this message can be heard, because that's what happened to this young man. And I want his story told, and I am ready to introduce him to the world as the man that killed my son and let him share his story. Hopefully we can save some children for ending up in a situation like he did. That was two lives lost. Let's bring the other life back to living. He's not dead. My son is gone. And it's not an easy thing. July is one of the worst months of the year that I have. I struggle a lot, not only with my son's death, but a lot of things. My mother died in July, so July is not a good month for me. But I have a mission. I have a purpose now. And my purpose is to give this young man another chance, because he has a story to tell, and hopefully we can save somebody else's son or daughter for going down that road of murdering someone.
Donna Foster, thanks so much for joining us today and sharing your story.
Thank you for inviting me.
Donna Foster, she's seeking the parole of Ohio prison inmate Roosevelt Barron, who murdered her son James Foster in 1991. For more information on Epidemic, the organization that Donna Foster referred to, we'll have a link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. David Singleton, thanks to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
And thank Academic.
and David Singleton, he's the director of the Ohio Justice and Policy Center. Thanks to Emmy Beach for producing this series. Thanks to all of the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants Olivia Rojas, Justice English, Emmy Beach, Josh Trannon, and Emily Williams. Justin English is leaving us tomorrow after about 6 months on the show, working with us on all kinds of topics and issues and roles. Justin, we've enjoyed having you with us, and we appreciate all of your help over the last months. Best wishes for every success on the West Coast. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.